Imagine somebody that you were married to for 3 years deciding to execute you. She would have been out of her mind with worry and grief and anxiety.
That was Susanna Lipscomb on Anne Boleyn.
People who believed that they had ownership in enslaved people came forwards in 1838 so that they could receive slave compensation monies.
And that was Kate Donnington discussing a project about British slave ownership. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. Visit historyextra.com/subscribe for subscription deals. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire and Google Play. And for details of our digital formats, including price, content and availability, head to historyextra.com/digital. On the 19th of May 1536, Henry VIII's second wife, Anne Boleyn, was beheaded at the Tower of London, after being found guilty of adultery, incest and conspiring the king's death. Since then, debate has raged as to whether Anne was indeed guilty as charged, or whether she was in fact the victim of a courtly conspiracy. Our section editor Charlotte Hodgman met Tudor historian Susanna Lipscomb at the Tower of London to find out what lay behind Henry's decision to execute his once beloved wife. And listen out for one of the famous Tower of London ravens in this interview.
Right, so Susanna, we're standing on Tower Green, the site of Anne Boleyn's execution in 1536. Can you perhaps take us through her last hours? What would have happened to her?
So Anne would have been told that she was going to be executed before, and actually when in the build-up to her execution she got quite hysterical and famously made that comment about having a little neck, which was thinking that the executioner could do his job swiftly. She then was brought out here onto Tower Green and mounted the scaffold. She removed her hood herself, which was an English gable hood rather than the French ones, and then took that off, and her ladies tied a blindfold around her eyes. She went out wearing a beautiful ermine robe, and of course that was taken off her gown. And then she knelt, and she was beheaded by an executioner who'd specially been brought from France, who beheaded her, or could behead a man or a woman whilst they knelt, with a sword as opposed to an axe. Because I think of her French background, she'd spent a lot of time in France, and as a kindness and a courtesy, people who were beheaded by axe quite often died horribly. The executioners weren't necessarily good at their jobs, whereas this was a swift, clean stroke.
And was that her request, or would that have been Henry?
We don't have any evidence that she requested it. I think the impetus came from Henry. And she died here, and it was about 8 o'clock in the morning. She also, before she died, made a short speech exhorting the small crowd of people, because it was a private execution, around her to be obedient to the king. And saying, I mean, actually speaking very nicely of him. She says that never was there a gentler or more merciful prince, and that to her he was ever a good and gentle and sovereign lord, which is quite surprising in the circumstances.
And just going back then to the beginning when they sort of first met, what was her appeal for Henry?
The interesting thing about Anne Boleyn is that she doesn't seem to have been phenomenally good-looking. Even her friends described her as good-looking enough, so sort of modestly pretty. But she was perhaps unusual at the time. We have to remember that at the time, sort of being very fair, being fair-haired, blue eyes was considered attractive. She had what was thought of as sallow skin, so she was sort of more tanned and darker hair and dark flashing eyes. So perhaps it wasn't her looks, but it was her character. She was sophisticated. She was cosmopolitan. She'd spent all this time in France. She spoke French, and Henry liked to speak French too. And she was witty and probably intelligent. And elegant as well. There was a, her character was very attractive, very appealing to him. Henry, interestingly, was attracted to strong women on the whole. Jane Seymour perhaps is an exception, but Catherine Parr, Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, they were all actually very strong, intelligent women. And he wasn't looking for someone who was going to be submissive most of the time.
And how does she compare then to Henry's first wife?
As I say, both of them were strong women, and Catherine of Aragon, of course, was the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. She'd been brought up by a woman who was a strong leader, a warrior, and Catherine was that. Catherine was pious. Anne Boleyn also was pious, but in very different ways, as we know. They were attracted to different parts of the church, different denominations in the end. But perhaps Anne was more outspoken than Catherine. Perhaps she had more of attraction to the court and the culture of the court, to dancing, to poetry, to the sort of things that Henry really enjoyed than Catherine did.
Okay. And the relationship between Henry and Anne has sort of famously been recorded as being quite tempestuous. Was that the case, and how did that change after they were married?
I think it was tempestuous. It's been described by both, actually, Eric Ives and George Bernard as being a sort of relationship of sunshine and storms, and I think that was true. But it was a very powerful attraction between them. As I understand it, Anne chose not to sleep with Henry in the time, the 6 or 7 years before they married.
Yeah.
And so there was obviously an attraction to her for something he wasn't getting. He couldn't feel like he could quite catch her, although it wasn't entirely sort of chase their relationship by any means. And I think that attraction remained strong after their marriage. We have descriptions of Henry and Anne throughout their marriage being described as merry together. They're described as merry together more than Henry and any of his other wives. And that carries on through into the autumn of 1535. They're both very disappointed and upset by Anne's miscarriage in January 1536, but for the most part, it does seem that they had an awfully good time with each other. I think we might need to think of them as a sort of a passionate couple who who argued but then made up as well.
And how did the public react to Anne, particularly when she was crowned?
Public reception of Anne wasn't great. There was a lot of support for Catherine of Aragon. And some of the comments that we have in the documentation about Anne call her things like a goggle-eyed whore. So that's just one person, but it maybe represents a feeling among the public. Of course, Henry wasn't terribly interested in the public. The public weren't terribly important in 16th century England. They weren't the people who made decisions. And ultimately, Henry wasn't that bothered, I don't suppose, by their opinions. But the small amount of evidence that we have suggests that there might have been hostility towards Anne.
And she famously miscarried a baby boy in January 1536. She already had Elizabeth at the time. And that was just 4 months before her execution. Do you think it was this that perhaps caused Henry to believe that their marriage was doomed and he would never have a son?
Of course, it must have been horrible for Henry and Anne to experience this miscarriage. It possibly wasn't her first. The evidence is rather unclear. I think it probably was, but there's a possibility that she miscarried in 1534 and even possibly in 1535. But this miscarriage, that they could identify at 3.5 months that it would have been a boy, must have been really, really hard on both of them. It must have seemed that history was repeating itself. Catherine of Aragon, of course, famously had 6 pregnancies and only one daughter, Princess Mary, survived. The others were stillbirth, the infant mortalities, you know, Prince Henry, who died at 7 weeks. And it must have been terribly upsetting to think that this was going to happen again. But there is that very long gap of 4 months. And I don't think that we have sufficient evidence to conclude that Henry therefore makes up his mind to get rid of Anne. In fact, I don't think that's what happens at all, in my opinion. Historians disagree wildly over what happened at Anne Boleyn's fall. So I don't think it was the final nail in the coffin by any means, but I think it would have been devastating to them both.
And once Henry had made the decision to put Anne aside, why did he not divorce her? I mean, he'd already divorced one wife. Why did he not do the same with Anne? Why did she have to die?
So, to be clear here, I don't think that Henry decided to get rid of Anne until presented with evidence of her adultery. That's my perspective on it. So when he thought that she was guilty of adultery, she was also charged with incest and conspiring the king's death. The crucial one is conspiring the king's death. According to the 1534 Treasons Act, to imagine the death of the king in words was treasonous.
Okay.
So the idea that she had been talking of his death and possibly hoping to make it happen meant that she'd committed high treason.
Mm.
So putting her aside, putting her in a nunnery or something wasn't an option. He did actually, of course, have their marriage annulled, which is what, you know, the thing we call divorce in inverted commas to Catherine of Aragon was their marriage was annulled. And he had his marriage to Anne Boleyn annulled as well before she died, so that her daughter Elizabeth became illegitimate and not in the line of succession. Henry later put Elizabeth back in the line of succession. But at the time, that seemed important. But it's really because what she did was treasonous.
And what evidence is there to say that she did, you know, imagine the king's death and speak of it?
We don't have the trial documents, which means that we don't have all the evidence we would need to know exactly what was going on. But we have other pieces of evidence from which we can derive a conclusion. And one of the pieces of evidence we have is a letter. There are a series of letters from Sir William Kingston, who was the constable of the Tower at the time, reporting what Anne herself had said when she was in the apartments just over there, waiting for her, awaiting her execution, awaiting her fate. And she was racking her brains to sort of figure out what had got her into this mess in the first place. And she reported a number of conversations with the men of the court. And one of them was with Henry VIII's friend, confidant, personal body servant, Sir Henry Norris. And in this conversation, Anne had teased him and said that if aught came to the king but good, you would look to have me. And this wonderful phrase, she says to him, "You look for dead men's shoes." Now, this is the only evidence that we have of Anne talking of the king's death. And it must be this that's the evidence that's used to suggest that she was conspiring the king's death, or there's something else in the trial documents we've lost, but that's all we've got.
And the accusations of adultery, were they real? Were they just used to besmirch her name even more?
I don't think that Anne was guilty of adultery with her brother or with anyone else. I think that Henry believed that she was, though. That's the crucial thing. The account that's most persuasive, and there were several different versions of what happened, either that it was that Anne was actually guilty, which is a case that's been argued by a historian called George Bernard at the University of Southampton. Professor Bernard thinks that actually what happened is, you know, just what's written there, that she did commit adultery and that there's no smoke without fire. Although even he will finally conclude that we should give him the Scottish verdict of not proven, and that means that she may well not be innocent, which is what we tend to conclude. But the evidence suggests to me that she was innocent. When she was here, she swore on peril of her soul's damnation, both before and after taking the Eucharist, that she was innocent, which was a really important act at this time. And Anne was a religious woman. She said to William Kingston, the constable of the Tower, that she was as clear from sin as he was, and that, you know, she was the king's true wedded wife. And ultimately, only one person, Mark Smeaton, confessed to adultery. All the others protested their innocence to the end. Anne protested her innocence to the end, at a time when, if you were going to die, if you were going to meet your maker, you would want to be shriven. You would want to confess and to be absolved. Mark Smeaton did confess, however. He confessed to sexual intercourse with the Queen on three occasions. Mark Smeaton was a commoner. He was a musician at the Queen's household. He was an easy target for Cromwell when Cromwell arrested him and interrogated him at his house in Stepney. And Smeaton was possibly tortured. We've got three accounts. One says he wasn't. One says he was racked here in the Tower. And one says that he had a rope tied around his head with knots in it that was tightened. So possibly he was just confessing under torture, although he never retracted it. Possibly there was something else going on. There's an account, again, from Anne's recollections of a conversation she had with Mark just before the accusations came about. And in it, he says to her something quite strange. He sort of treats her with a great deal of familiarity, which, given that he was a commoner, was an odd thing to do. Now, one could use that as evidence that they were having an affair, of course. The way that she dismisses him and says, you cannot look to have me, pay the attention to you that I would pay to a noble person, suggests that she finds his behaviour quite odd. And my complete speculation, but my theory is that there's that actually something of the way he responds to her reminds me of stalkers of celebrities, that there's a sort of he thinks a kudos will be conferred on him by the act of saying he's committed adultery with the Queen. All the recent work by psychologists on confessions, forced confessions, and confessions when people haven't done anything, when they're not even forced, voluntary confessions, fantasy, all of that's very powerful, and I think applies in this case. So in short, I don't think she was guilty.
You've mentioned Thomas Cromwell, famously painted as quite a shady character in Anne's death. Do you think he was behind it? Was it a plot between him and the Seymours, who wanted to get Jane Seymour onto the throne in Anne's place?
That's a powerful theory that was being put forward, perhaps most cogently by Eric Ives, and it's based on a piece of evidence in a letter written by Eustace Chapuy, who was the imperial ambassador to Charles V, his master, the Holy Roman Emperor. And Chapuy says that Cromwell has said to him in the letters in French, il se mit à fantaser et conspirer le dit affaire. He set himself to think up and to conspire the said affair. And so this piece of evidence, the he in question, of course, just like in Hilary Mantel's books, is Cromwell. And so the he in question being Cromwell means that he himself has plotted against Anne. But this piece of evidence was often used without consulting the sentence before, which suggests that the person who had told Cromwell to do this was actually Henry. It says that he'd been authorised and commissioned by the king to bring an end to the mistress's trial, to do which he had thought up managed, essentially, conspired. This could be the whole affair. So it suggests that Henry had told Cromwell to do it, and therefore Henry VIII can't be taken out of the picture. Now, the question is, of course, about whether there was a plot with Jane Seymour or the Seymours to get Jane on the throne. And Eric Ives suggested that actually Jane was being coached to try and interest Henry, that she was being coy, just in the way that Anne had been, and that that's what's going on. The thing is, it's not persuasive for me, personally, because I don't think that Cromwell had sufficient reason to want to get rid of his erstwhile ally, Anne, on the questions of differing opinions on foreign policy, what to do with the money from the dissolution of the monasteries. They're not, it seems to me, sufficiently robust motives to destroy a queen. And we've always got to remember Henry's part in it. So I think that Cromwell was operating on instruction and not independently.
Anne was refused an audience with Henry, wasn't she, before her death. Do you think that perhaps she could have persuaded Henry to go back on his decision to have her executed if she'd been allowed to see him?
I think she probably could have done. I mean, famously, Catherine Parr had a moment where she persuaded Henry that she wasn't a heretic when there was an accusation made against her, possibly by Stephen Gardiner, Bishop of Winchester, that she was. She met with Henry, and there's that famous speech from The Taming of the Shrew. Looks very close to John of Caterina, sort of, is very close to John Fox's account of what Catherine Parr said to Henry. Now, who knows where John Fox got that from, and if he was just making it up all himself. But it suggests that Catherine had persuaded Henry. I'm sure that if Anne had had a chance to do the same, she would have been just as persuasive.
And Anne's trial, I mean, the buildings that it was held in are no longer here at the Tower, are they? Was it a foregone conclusion, do you think? Was it an actual trial?
It couldn't be an actual trial because it happened 3 days after the trial of the other men involved. And once they'd been found guilty of adultery with Anne, she had to be found guilty of adultery with them. It happened just in the Great Hall, which was over here. It was a huge place. It could hold 2,000 people. And Anne and her brother were tried together on the 15th of May. And they were tried by their peers, by peers of the realm. And all of them found Anne guilty. And the extraordinary thing, of course, is it was conducted by her uncle, the Duke of Norfolk. A very scheming, unpleasant man. But, you know, I wonder what he must have thought as he condemned his niece to die. Yeah.
And how important do you think Anne is to English history?
I think it's fair to say that Anne has acquired an importance that perhaps is disproportionate sort of to her place. And that's partly to do with the fact that we think of her in a sort of almost a kind of proto-feminist, you know, that she was somebody who knew what she wanted and got what she wanted and held out for, you know, that sort of thing. But of course, it depends how much responsibility you give her for persuading Henry towards the break with Rome. I suppose just the fact that he wanted her ultimately, and possibly that she gave him things like the Obedience of a Christian Man by William Tyndale, in which it said it was shameful for princes to be under the authority of popes, that sort of thing, persuaded Henry that actually he should be in direct line to God and there shouldn't be anyone intervening, and he wanted to marry her. So in that way, I suppose she could be held responsible for one of the most important moments of English history. That break, which has been so fundamental to defining our sense of our national identity and creating a sense that we are an island nation and have a special sort of role.
And do you think later queens were able to learn anything from Anne's mistakes or you know, how she was treated?
It doesn't seem so. Jane Seymour apparently at one point started to intervene in the dissolution of the monasteries, and according to the account that we have, Henry said that, you know, a previous queen had meddled and look what had happened to her. So perhaps that sort of sense that she was involved in politics was not very good, but Jane obviously didn't learn immediately from that. And Catherine Howard certainly didn't learn. Catherine Howard, I think, probably was guilty of adultery. There's a letter that she wrote to Thomas Culpepper that she signs off yours as long as life endures, which rather telling. I think she was foolish, and she didn't certainly... I mean, for goodness sake, a wife of your, you know, has been killed for committing adultery, or at least on the... you know, the accusation that she's committed adultery, and you're a young bride of that husband who did that, and you think, yes, I'll entertain this young good-looking man in my rooms, and that's all going to work out fine. So, no, I don't think they learned.
No, it doesn't sound like it. And how do you think Elizabeth felt growing up with a father who'd had her mother executed and then, you know, declared her illegitimate?
It's obviously very hard to know. I think she treasured her mother's memory. She wore a ring which has a picture of Elizabeth, and I mean, some have argued it could be a young Elizabeth, but it could well, I think, be Anne Boleyn in this little sort of locket type enamel ring, and she was wearing that at her death, so it's possible, I think, that she actually really did hold her mother very close to her heart. It must have been awful to think that her husband, her father, had destroyed her mother. It must have really stayed with her, and yet she was very proud of her father as well. She had a very complicated legacy.
Yeah. We told our Facebook and Twitter fans that we were coming to meet you at the Tower of London today, and they sent some questions in. So Darcy Mayers and Matt Orton wanted to know whether there's any evidence behind the rumours that Anne had six fingers on each hand.
The answer is not reliable evidence. There was a chap called Nicholas Sander, who was a Catholic, writing in Elizabeth's reign. And many of the misconceptions that we have about Anne come from his writing. He obviously wasn't a big fan. and he describes her having a large wart, goitre, and the six fingers come from that, from him. But he's writing 50 years after her death.
Yeah.
He didn't know her. He's not going on descriptions, as far as we're aware. I think it's just about creating an image of a monster, and a monster in the conception of the 16th century. A monstrous person needs to have a monstrous appearance. Of course, it's, you know, things that's thrown at Richard III, for example. Mm. So that's where it comes from. It doesn't mean she did.
Okay. And Philippa Connolly, also on Twitter, wants to know, why is Anne still such a source of fascination for people?
It's partly because of her historic significance in the break with Rome, but I think it's often largely to do with a sense of her character. I am always amazed by the extraordinary levels of devotion to Anne in sites like the Anne Boleyn Files or Tudor History or, you know, all these wonderful sites online that talk about Anne Boleyn in the footsteps of Anne Boleyn is another one. And the comments that people put on there suggest that for many people she's a source of inspiration, in that they have a sense of her being a woman who followed her heart, did what she thought was right, who was a woman of strong convictions, who didn't cave to Henry, who waited for what she wanted, which was to be married. And there's a sense that she's almost seen as this kind of proto-feminist heroine.
Yeah.
It is about an idea of Anne as much as the historic Anne.
Okay.
But it's a very persuasive one.
Yeah, very. And just looking at the people sort of crowded around, you know, the site where she was executed, you definitely get a feel of that here, don't you? Kelly Lynch wants to know, does Anne get enough credit for Elizabeth I's successful reign?
I think she probably does get enough credit, because Anne, unfortunately, wasn't around long enough to bring her daughter up. I think the person who was particularly pivotal in forming Elizabeth's character was Catherine Parr, her stepmother, who was herself a strong woman who led the country in Henry VIII's absence when he was away in France fighting the wars, and who was a woman of piety and who demonstrated to Elizabeth what a queen might look like. So I think, obviously, whilst Elizabeth inherited certain things and certain characteristics possibly from her mother, she was very sadly not around during her formative years, and we have to look to others to understand why Elizabeth was as she was.
And just finally, Michelle Bronson on Facebook wanted to know, is it true that Anne's stillborn son, the one that was miscarried in 1536, was he actually deformed in some way? Is there evidence to suggest that?
The evidence, again, comes from Nicholas Sander, that Catholic, writing 50 years later. So he says that Anne gave birth to a shapeless mass of flesh, which has been used to suggest that the fetus was deformed. There's absolutely no evidence at the time, from 1536, that there was anything wrong with the fetus, apart from it being only three and a half months old. I mean, you know, possibly there was. Possibly there was a reason why she miscarried, but there is no reliable evidence to sustain it at all. And it's become so salacious as a theory, it's been used to suggest that she was involved in witchcraft, or, you know, that was because of the deformity that Henry looked at it and thought, oh, I must get rid of Anne. And, you know, there's nothing to sustain that at all. So if we walk away from Tower Green, just over there, actually, before we leave, though, is the bell tower. You can't see it now because there are these Elizabethan buildings in front of it. But Jane Spooner, who's the curator of historic buildings here, tells me that when Anne was executed, there would have been a clear view to Tower Green. And that's where Sir Thomas Wyatt, the poet, was imprisoned. He was accused, but somehow managed to get off. And he would have seen Anne's execution. And he says in poetry afterwards that this dreadful sight sticks in his head day and night. And also says that he would rather die himself, aged after the common trace, than dazed with dreadful face, which is the terrible courtly alternative that he's seen here. And if we go this way, we're heading towards the area where Anne's apartments would have been.
Okay.
No longer standing. But if we go up here, we'll be able to see where they were.
And Anne's execution, who actually would have been present at the her beheading?
It wasn't a public execution. Unlike the executions on Tower Hill, which would have been, could have been a crowd of thousands,
It
was just a small number of people. It would have been people, possibly people like ambassadors, high nobility, very few people. Mm-hmm. Her ladies there were there with her. Henry was not. And on our way to go and see those apartments, this is Traitor's Gate. So in the 16th century, this would have gone, the Thames would have come up this far. And
this is where she would have arrived.
Yeah. It's not technically, it's called Traitor's Gate now. It's it's the water gate at St. Thomas's Tower.
And then taken up to the apartments.
That's right. Taken to the apartments that she had stayed in before her coronation.
Oh, right.
Which must have been so bitter for her. Can we just walk through here?
Mm-hmm.
So this space here, just near the White Tower.
Now near the shop.
Now near the Ravens shop, yes, and the Ravens enclosures, would have been the area of the private apartments.
And how long was she there for again? Sorry, before she was there
for 3 weeks.
Okay. And was she allowed to walk in the grounds, or was she confined to her quarters?
As far as I know, she was confined, but I haven't read anything about. I haven't come across any evidence of her being out in the garden. So she was brought here on the 2nd of May, 1536, and executed on the 19th. So almost 3 weeks. Must have been a terrible time.
And do you think she expected to die? Do you think during that time she thought that would happen?
It's hard to know. I mean, at first she's protesting her innocence and saying that they can, only accuse her and they can't produce any witnesses and therefore she will have justice. But as time goes on, and presumably, she doesn't get to see Henry, so that must have been an indicator of what was happening. As time went on, she seems to have experienced all sorts of different emotions and become quite hysterical and, made these wild prophecies about whether it would, if it rained or it wouldn't rain again if she was killed, and that he'd send her to a nunnery and all sorts of different wild speculations. And I think she was sort of losing it, really.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine somebody that you were married to for 3 years deciding to execute you. I mean, it was... She would have been out of her mind with worry and grief and anxiety.
And was she able to see her daughter during that time?
Yes, she wouldn't have been allowed to say goodbye. Strangely enough, recreating exactly what had happened in terms of the separation of mother and daughter between Catherine of Aragon and Mary. So even when Catherine of Aragon was dying, Mary wasn't allowed to see her mother. Both of these girls grew up without their mothers at crucial times and yet became our first Queen's Regnant. But there's one final place we must visit whilst we're here, which is the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula, which is where Anne is actually buried.
So when she was after the execution, was she taken straight to the chapel?
She was put in a simple arrow chest and she was buried in an unmarked grave in the chapel. It's now under the floor, up at the altar end. It wasn't designed to be a place of pilgrimage. It wasn't designed for people to visit her and memorialise her. So here we are in the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula. So it's thought that Anne is buried near here, under the altar. And this is where she was brought, just a short distance away from where she was executed. There are many people buried in this chapel. Anne was one of only seven who was executed on Tower Green, and therefore buried here. I mean, also Lady Jane Grey, for example, buried here.
Mm.
Catherine Howard.
the three queens under this floor.
It's interesting, there's no sort of marker for her grave at all, really, is there? I mean, there's a stone on the floor with her name, but nothing to kind of show that there's somebody buried there.
Yes, but people come and they are still moved by just knowing that she was here. And it is a moving space, isn't it?
Yeah. So why was it the way that she was, the way that she died and the circumstances surrounding it, that's why she didn't, there is nothing to really say that she's here.
She was disgraced. She was disgraced. She was a traitor, according to the law of the land. Interestingly, she was accused of adultery, incest, and conspiring the king's death. And adultery wasn't actually technically treason. Okay. If you violated the queen under the treason law of 1352, that was treason. But consensual adultery wasn't treason. It had to be made a crime in the indictment, the attainder against Catherine Howard. So it was only this conspiring the king's death. And she wasn't accused of witchcraft either, which everyone always says. But it was because she was a traitor by the terms of the law of the land, that she had an unmarked grave. And this is just, you know, the nearest chapel.
So we're talking to one of the beef eaters here at the Tower of London. Oh, what's your name?
Rob.
Hello, Rob. What do you think of Anne Boleyn? Do you think she was guilty? Did she deserve to die?
Yeah, she had a lot of enemies in the court, but she also had a lot of friends. And when you consider that the king couldn't get what he actually wanted and he just wanted rid of her, why he didn't divorce her is beyond me, because he got rid of the first one that way. He got his man to conjure up a load of charges. A brother and everyone else copped it as well, so it's not the best times. But I don't think she deserved the ending that she actually got. God rest her soul. So lots of people come up here and lay flowers on the on her graveside, which is kind of nice. And there's a basket of red roses that, unknown, we don't know who the benefactor is, but they're placed on her grave in the Chapel Royal every year on the anniversary of her death. Yes.
And has many fans.
She has lots of fans in and around the globe. A lot of people, a lot of females, she's got lots of support there. And some ladies I've let go into the chapel and have a look. Some of them have actually sunk to their knees and burst out crying as if she's, you know, a nearest and dearest relative. So, you know, they can empathise and, more importantly, sympathise with her.
That was Susanna Lipscombe and Charlotte Hodgman on location at the Tower of London. Susanna has written a feature on Anne Boleyn for our April issue, which goes on sale today, as it happens. And in fact, our April issue is something of a Tudor special, as we also have pieces on the Spanish Armada and Tudor eating habits. Plus, you can also find out what it was like to live like a Roman and discover how the Normans transformed England's churches. You can get hold of this magazine in all good newsagents and digitally. And details of all of that are on our website, historyextra.com. And I should also mention that Susanna Lipscombe is going to be appearing on BBC4 next Wednesday, presenting Hidden Killers of the Victorian Home. It will be broadcast at 9 p.m. and should be a really interesting programme. And now we have a short advert.
Author Gordon Campbell discusses the curious phenomenon of the ornamental hermit in the 18th century.
The phenomenon of the ornamental hermit is a very curious one. In the 18th century, landowners constructed buildings in their gardens, things like classical temples, for example. And some landowners in some kinds of gardens constructed hermitages. And these were either places where they could go themselves to be melancholy, or they were places where they hired an ornamental hermit to sit in the hermitage and to represent melancholy and sobriety of thinking.
The Hermit in the Garden, From Imperial Rome to Ornamental Gnome, by Gordon Campbell, is available now directly from Oxford University Press and all good bookshops.
A website recently launched by University College London allows people to explore their ancestors' involvement in slave ownership in the British Caribbean, as well as providing a wealth of information about abolition in 1833. Kate Donnington, a researcher on the project, spoke to BBC History magazine's Matt Elton about the research.
So when did the project start?
Well, the project actually stemmed from some exceptional PhD research by Nick Draper, who then went on to become one of the project research associates. So Nick started his PhD research, and he wanted to work with the slave compensation registers, which are available in the National Archives. And Nick wanted to investigate who the slave owners were at the ending of British Caribbean slavery. So really the project stemmed from Nick's PhD research, which was then turned into an award-winning book, The Price of Emancipation. And then Nick, together with his supervisor, Catherine Hall, and another research associate, Keith McClelland, the three of them came up with this project, the Legacies of British Slave Ownership Project, which has been funded by the ESRC, the Economic Social Research Council. And that project began in 2009 and was fully funded for 3 years. So in many ways, the project kind of stemmed from some of the 2007 bicentenary commemorations of the abolition of the slave trade as well. The people on the project felt that British history tended to focus on the ending of slavery rather than this much longer history of participation. And so as a project, they wanted to put the history of slave ownership back into the narrative of British history.
What new information is now available online as a result of the project?
Well, the project has involved a major digitisation of the transcriptions of the slave compensation registers. So the slave compensation registers were really a kind of an epic work of bureaucracy. People who believed that they had ownership in enslaved people came forwards in 1838 so that they could receive slave compensation money. So one of the measures in order to secure the abolition of slavery in 1838 was the payment of compensation to slave owners. And this was based on the idea that enslaved people were considered to be property. And if the government was going to interfere with property rights, it had to compensate the property owners. And that was the mechanism through which slave ownership compensation money was paid. So these people came forwards, they gave details which included their names, their addresses, their gender, where their estates were, and who they believed that they had ownership of in terms of the figures of people. You don't get information which gives you any kind of detail of who the enslaved were in the slave compensation registers. But what you do get is this kind of basic biographical information on people who believed that they were slave owners. And so what the project has done is digitized all of this information. And these documents are actually freely available at the National Archives. But of course, you have to be able to get to the National Archives. You have to have the time to make that trip. So it was very important to us that this information be digitized, because there are many people outside of the London area who would be very interested in this, both at a national and an international level. So the first process was to digitize that basic information. Then to build on that, what we've done is we've built biographical entries. So if you think of something like the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, it's using that kind of biographical information to build a picture of who the slave owners were, what kinds of activities they undertook, where their impacts were felt. So we've built these biographies using different research strands. So There were a variety of kind of research areas that the project were interested in. So the first of those was the commercial legacies of British slave ownership. So one of the ways in which people can search the database is by looking at commercial firms that slave owners invested in. So they were very one of the more interesting facets of where slave ownership money ended up was the building of the railways. And we've been able to trace things like commercial investment in the railways. The next strand that we looked at was political legacies. So were slave owners or former slave owners involved in political culture, either at local level or at national level? The next strand that we looked at was the cultural legacies of British slave ownership. And this looked at the ways in which money amassed during slave ownership was then used to build things like collections of art or collections of books. We tried to trace in part where some of these collections ended up. We also looked at whether or not some of the slave owners were involved in the founding of any institutions or galleries or museums. So the next one was looking at the establishment of historical memories. So some of these slave owners went on to write about the West Indies, either in fictional accounts or in memoirs. And we've tried to trace who these people were, what kind of works were they authoring, what sort of a picture of the West Indies and its inhabitants had they painted. So the final research strand that we looked at was the physical imprint left behind by former slave owners. So many slave owners were very interested in establishing some sort of legacy for themselves, particularly an inheritance for their children. So a lot of them were involved in, for example, the building of country houses and also in the improvement of existing structures.
So was there anything that particularly surprised you during the course of all this research?
In terms of something that was, you know, quite a surprise, and I think it was definitely a surprise for the whole of the team, was the degree to which there was actually a relative gender balance between men and women in terms of people claiming slave compensation money. So around about the sort of 40 to 45% mark of all claimants were women. And this was definitely a surprise for the team. We hadn't been expecting it to be quite such a large number of women. I mean, the thing that separated the claims between men and women were that men tended to claim on a very large scale. So male slave owners tended to own large amounts of land. So they would have a very large enslaved workforce, whereas women didn't tend to own the land. And that was part of the kind of the coverture laws in Britain, whereby a woman's property would become the property of her husband on marriage. So women's land tended to be absorbed into their husband's ownership. But even so, women still made up almost half of all claimants, but they tended to own enslaved people on a much smaller scale, so maybe one or two enslaved people. And this came as a result of some of the ways in which ownership was transferred between people. So women might have something like an annuity settled on them, which would then give them ownership of maybe one or two enslaved people. And this would act as a kind of financial security for them to bring them in a small but regular income. A number of women actually felt that the slave compensation process was unfair towards these small-scale female owners who didn't have any land. So their only source of income was the enslaved labour. And so they felt that there was a disparity between the ways in which, you know, men were enabled to carry on profiting because they still owned land and could employ newly emancipated former slaves, whereas these women who survived on the income of an annuity on a single enslaved person would lose everything. And so there are a number of very interesting letters which go along with the slave compensation registers, which document these women protesting to the government, asking for an increase in compensation effectively. In terms of what the enslaved people that they owned might have been doing, normally, if you just owned a couple of enslaved people, then you might have them as domestic workers, or alternatively, people would work in what was known as jobbing gangs. And working in a jobbing gang was one of the worst experiences for enslaved people, because they were literally sent to do some of the jobs that no one else wanted to do. They were a hired gang of workers, and they would go and do things like dig the cane holes, which was incredibly intensive labor, which most enslaved people really, really dreaded. So these were some of the kinds of jobs that these kind of roaming gangs would do.
You touched there on some letters. What sort of documents have been involved in this project, and how did you go about digitising them for the website?
Well, a vast, vast range of documents have been used in this process. One of the things that we wanted to do was to really gain a whole picture of the lives of slave owners, which meant adopting a practice which would take in different types of history. So the different people that have worked on the project brought with them specialisms in cultural history, social history, economic and commercial history, political history, and genealogical family history. And this has involved working with a real range of documents. So we drew biographical material from things like the Dictionary of National Biography, the History of Parliament Online. We used census data and electoral registers. I'm now very familiar with Burke's Peerage. We went through newspapers like the Times Archive and the London Gazette, and they were used to glean information on various commercial investments, charitable donations, because if people donated to charity, often it was then publicised in the newspaper, and marriages and deaths and political activities were also documented in newspapers.
So in terms of actually digitising them for the online side of things, what did that involve?
The basis of the digitisation project has been digitising the slave compensation registers. Now, all the other biographical information has been digitised in the sense that we've written histories of where we've been able to get the information, we've written histories of each of the individual slave owners. And all of the sources that we've used to put together the biographical detail are listed at the bottom of each biographical entry, so that people can then take those sources and they can go and do their own research. So there might be things in those sources that other people will want to use or will be able to interpret in a different way to what the project has done. And so what we've done is included all that source information so that people then can go away and do their own research.
So how can people contribute to the site? Are there any ways that they can get involved directly?
Absolutely. And we really want to stress that this is a collaborative project, and people have contributed already, and there is actually a built-in mechanism in the database for people to continue to contribute, because we recognise that we've been a small team, and the rest of the work that needs to be done is going to be undertaken by many hands. So if you go to the Legacies of British Slave Ownership database, so that's at www.ucl.ac.uk/LBS. You can not only search the database, but you can also contribute yourself. So if you type in the name of someone that you're particularly interested in and you bring up their biographical detail, on the right-hand side of the page, there is an icon that you can click which says, "Is this correct? Would you like to contribute more?" So if you click on that icon, it takes you through to a page where you can then contribute the information that you want to. The page will ask you for the sources that you've used so that they can be independently verified by the team. And then once we've verified the sources and that everything is accurate, that information is then put into the database, and whoever contributes towards the biographical entry will then have their work recognised with their name on the encyclopedia page that they've contributed towards.
And finally, I suppose, are there any particularly revealing or interesting case studies that you especially like?
Well, I'm especially interested in the Hibbert family. They're the subject of my PhD thesis. So I find them to be a fascinating family. I also think in many ways they kind of encapsulate the broad range of activities that slave owners were involved in. So as a family, there's 11 of them in the database, and altogether they received £103,000 with one individual, George Hibbert, who was the kind of the patriarch of the family. He individually received £63,000, which is roughly the equivalent of around £43 million in today's money. So to give you an idea of what that would mean at the time, an average worker, maybe a skilled artisan in the 1830s, would be on a wage of between about £50 and £70 a year. So that's the scale at which the Hibberts were receiving slave compensation money. And the Hibberts invested their money in all kinds of different ways. As I mentioned earlier, they invested heavily in the arts. They had huge art collections and book collections. They built and renovated many country houses, both in the home counties close to London and also close to their native Manchester in Cheshire. On top of that, they invested £26,500 in railway schemes. They invested in the West India docks. So they were really involved in all these different areas of our research strands. And I find them to be a very fascinating family, because they have actually, you know, managed to maintain and sustain themselves over actually a much longer history. The Hibberts family history of slave ownership goes right the way back to the early parts of the 18th century. And they were still involved at the ending of colonial slavery in 1833. And actually, if you look them up, you can see on the commercial legacy strand of the database that they continued to work as a West India merchant company right the way through into the 1860s. So we're talking about, three, four generations worth of a single family who were able to maintain themselves through this relationship with, first of all, slavery and the slave economy, and then later, after emancipation, they continued their involvement with the West Indies.
That was Kate Donington talking to Matt Elton. To visit the website for yourself, head to ucl.ac.uk/LBS. And that's almost all for this week. Do let us know what you think. You can email us, podcast@historyextra.com. You can follow us on Twitter, we're at History Extra, or on Facebook, we're facebook.com/historyextra. Next week, we'll be taking a trip to the British Museum's new Pompeii and Herculaneum exhibition, and we'll be broadcasting the winners of the Young Historians podcast competition. Do join us for that. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.